was exceptional piano playing, so thank you, Violet. And the second piano was the best second piano I have ever heard. So, anyways, we're going to continue our series in the parables. So we'll start as we have each of the last, this will be week 7, and so we'll look at our outline here to get us started. And remember, this is Christ's primary focus in his message on earth was that the kingdom had come, that he had initiated it, that it was going to grow, and that eventually it would come to completion. But even before it comes to full completion, we have responsibilities to live and to expand the kingdom today. And so in terms of the outline, right, so we've started with kingdom identity, which was really addressing two questions. Who is allowed to enter the kingdom? And the answer is, thankfully, anyone can enter the kingdom. Then we answer the second question, well, how do people enter the kingdom? There's only one way, it's through the forgiveness of Jesus Christ. Because of his forgiveness, we should be appropriately today more willing to forgive those who sin and around us. Then we talked about kingdom living. So now that if you identify in the kingdom, what are the expectations with which you should live and that we need to give all in the kingdom? And just because, you know, Christ gave all in his sacrifice for us, so our response should be to give all for him. What we're going to talk about today and next week then is this last element, which is this comparison between what it means to be religious versus what it means to have a relationship. And we're not necessarily going to concentrate explicitly, say, on salvation per se, but almost as much on the attitude that we should have as Christians. What should our relationship look like, the attitude that we should have? So we're going to talk about three parables today. And before we actually get to the first parable, if you want to go ahead and start turning, you can go to Luke chapter 18. That's where we're going to be first. But there's three parables that we're going to talk about today, and I've labeled this slide, parable or not. So if you look, some sources will say there are 38 specific parables in scriptures. Other places will say 35, yet other places will give a different number. So how can we come to different numbers if we're all looking at the same? And it has the discrepancy really comes in terms of how we define a parable and which things are considered parables and which actually aren't. So the three that we're going to talk about today are the Pharisaical prayer. So we'll look at the account of the Pharisee versus the tax collector or publican and the comparison and contrast between their prayers. We're then going to look at the rich man and Lazarus, and then we'll complete the discussion today talking about the parable of the two sons. The one who says he will do something and doesn't versus the one who says he isn't going to do it and then goes back and does it, and we'll look at what that represents. So it seemed like all three of these are parables, but some would say that this second one, the rich man and Lazarus, is not actually a parable. It gives an account of a specific name, and so it seems to suggest that these are specific people. And so it really all comes down to how we define what a parable actually is. And so to give you some context here, so if you go to Webster's Dictionary, it defines a parable as a short, and here's the key word, fictitious story that illustrates a religious principle. So if the account of the rich man and Lazarus is actually of a real person or real people in a real event, then by Webster's definition, this would not be a parable. However, if you look at the word parable, which is, we looked at this day one in the study, para and bol means to cast alongside or to set beside each other, to kind of set up a comparison and contrast. Well, if you think in that way, then you have the comparison and contrast of the rich man and Lazarus and how different they are. And in that context, then it would seem like, yes, this could be considered a parable. So it's like, is it or isn't it? And so I kind of came down to this tiebreaker that the purpose of a parable, and we've seen this in many of the passages we looked at, it'll talk about a parable and say, hey, Christ talks about the kingdom of heaven and he gives this parable to illustrate it. So if the account of the rich man and Lazarus gives us a comparison and contrast, and it also helps to reveal the kingdom, then I don't think it, even if it is about real people, I don't think it would be misappropriate to categorize it as a parable. And that's why I've gone ahead and included it. So even though it might not be, quote, a true parable, I think it helps us to understand the kingdom a little bit better, and so we're going to talk about it today. So, as I said, we're going to be in Luke chapter 18, and we're starting in verse 9, and we're going to talk, if you have a study Bible, probably at the beginning there it says, Jesus tells the parable of two men who prayed. And so starting in verse 9, it says this, and he spoke this parable unto certain people who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. So really, he's talking about the Pharisees here. That's probably the easiest way to think about it. And he gives this parable in verse 10. Two men went up into the temple to pray, the one a Pharisee and the other a publican. The Pharisee stood and prayed within himself, saying, God, or with himself, saying, God, I thank thee that I am not as the other men are, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this publican. I fast twice in the week. I give tithes of all that I possess. And the publican, here's the contrast, standing afar off, would not lift so much his eyes unto heaven, but smote upon his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other, for everyone who exalts himself shall be abased, and he that humbles himself shall be exalted. So we have this situation here. We have dedicated times of prayer that take place at the temple. So this would take place in the temple court, and strict Jews would come to the temple four times a day. So they would pray at 9 a.m., at noon, at 3 p.m., and at 6 p.m. And if you were dedicated to the law and you were a strict Jew, you would come at each of those times. So the parable doesn't denote which of those times this would be, but the context is it would be one of those times. So the situation is two men arrive to pray, and we have this Pharisee. Pharisees were dedicated to the law. We know that, right? Their whole purpose was they wanted to define the law and live as close and as tightly to the law as possible. And in fact, they took the law and extended it and added as many things to it as they could and to try to get all these details. This may not be an appropriate comparison, but I was thinking a lot about this. And to me, the Pharisee is like the media influencer of today. What does a media influencer do? They set themselves up to be observed and admired. Their whole point is to attract a following and to get as many people to like what they're doing and to follow them as possible. That's essentially what the Pharisee did. Beyond that, the Pharisee thought of themselves as religious royalty. So if you think about, for example, you take a country like India, which maybe not so bad today, but historically has had a caste system. So you'd have those that were in the upper caste and those that were outcast. Would they ever in any way interact with each other? No, right? And so if I'm a Pharisee, I am only going to interact with other Pharisees. I'll let other people observe me and admire me and want to be me, but I'm not going to interact with anybody else. That's the Pharisee in this context. So they're standing up to pray, which is normal, but the difference here is it's like the Pharisee comes into the court and he takes the central place of prominence in the prayer area and begins to pray. The publican, doesn't matter, finds a place where he can do his prayer as humbly as possible. So that's the kind of the difference here. So dedicated times of prayer. And the first thing to note here is that if you look at the prayer of the Pharisee, it appears that he is more pleased with himself than he is with God, right? I mean, he thanks him. It's kind of like me saying, oh God, I thank you that you have made me so good. I mean, that's essentially what he's saying, right? I can't believe that I am blessed to be the person that I am, right? He's just essentially putting himself up there. He then goes on to talk about all the things that he doesn't do or all the things that he does. So for example, he talks about fasting twice a week. So Jews were only required to fast on the Day of Atonement. So not only is he going well above that, he's going beyond that. He's fasting not even just once a week, he's fasting twice a week. And while this is a parable, and so it's kind of generally a fictitious account, if this were real life, and this were the Pharisee, and he were fasting twice a week, I can probably tell you what days he was fasting on. He was fasting on Monday and Thursday. You say, how would I know that? Because that's the days that the Jews would actually come together and have their midweek services at the temple. So that he would want to be fasting when others could observe that he was actually fasting. Again, it's all for show. It's all external. He then talks about giving tithes of all his income. And then he concludes with, I'm thankful that I'm not like this sinner over here. That's the first, okay? Now, if you look, and we'll get to the publican or the tax collector on the next slide, but I want to note this last point here, the difference between negative goodness and positive goodness. So he really, the Pharisee here really focuses on negative goodness, meaning he focuses on the things he does not do. So he says, I do not extort. I am not unjust. I am not an adulterer. It's all these things that he didn't do or that he simply avoided doing. And in the Jewish world, their focus was basically, if you think about the old model, don't do unto others what you don't want them to do unto you. That was like the Jewish motto. As long as you weren't evil or didn't do things to others that was bad or that you didn't want done to you, then you were okay. But remember, day one, when we did this series, I talked about this phrase, the great inversion. So if you think back to the Sermon on the Mount, what did Jesus do? He says, okay, you have heard it said that you shouldn't kill or murder. But, let's invert this, I say unto you that if you're angry with your brother, you've already committed murder in your heart. Okay? And so he inverts this thinking, and it's not that he just wants us to avoid doing bad things. He wants us to also do good. So it would be like, instead of saying we shouldn't do bad to other people, we should do good to all those around us. So instead of saying, oh, I didn't injure anybody, it really should be, I helped this person. And if you have negative goodness, it's a lot easier to be prideful because it's really easy to say, I just simply didn't do this. It's a lot harder to say, I helped everybody I could at every point in time in every way possible, right? And it's this idea of comparison that we're going to get to in even a little bit more detail. So then we get to the contrast here, the sinful tax collector. He is overwhelmed by his unworthiness. So to give you a little bit of history here, so in the Roman world, Rome would declare tax. And they would say, they would hire a tax collector in every area. And the tax collector was responsible for collecting all the taxes and then remitting them to the Roman government. And the Roman government would essentially say, okay, you are required to raise this much tax. And any tax that was collected over that, guess what happened with it? The tax collector got to keep it. So what do you think they would do? They would overcharge. It'd kind of be like, you know, our sales tax, not if you go out to eat, but like our general sales tax is 7%. So if you went into a commercial place of business and you bought something and they charged you 8% sales tax, but they only had to remit 7% to the government, they got to keep that spread. They got to keep the 1%, right? So there's obviously this incentive to extort and to take money that wasn't appropriate. And there were four types of taxes. There was a poll tax, which was basically a set amount for every person. So if you were living, you had to pay a certain amount of tax. There was a land tax. So if you had a farm and you grew a certain amount of crops, you would have to give 10% of that as a tax. Here's the one I really liked. You have an income tax, 1%. Boy, that would be, yeah, I thought that sounded pretty good. But then you think about all the other taxes they're paying. Where most of the, a lot of the abuse came from was on what was called a customs tax. This would be like if you had to use a toll, or like if you were, you know, let's say you're going down to Louisville and you have to cross the bridge and you got to pay a toll, that would be a customs tax. So if you wanted to use a road or cross a bridge, there would be customs. Here's where it got, so they would charge extra and they keep that. And then it got even worse because if you were unable to, actually, how many of you have seen The Chosen? Okay, a number of you. So if you remember early, we've made it through about 4 episodes, okay? So we started about 4 years ago. We have a very busy life. So we have all these things we want to watch down the road, but we'll get there. But I remember in one of the earlier episodes, one of the earlier episodes, one of them is a tax collector, not the disciple, but Peter, I think, owes money in The Chosen or something, and he has to come up with all these funds to pay. And what essentially has happened there is kind of realistic, is the tax collectors, if you couldn't pay, they would actually loan you money. It'd be like a loan shark. And then they would charge you exorbitant amounts of interest. Okay, and this was bad for the Jews, not only because they didn't like paying tax to the Roman government, but also, if you remember Jewish law, they weren't allowed to charge excessive interest. right? They weren't allowed to extort from their brothers, right? And so particularly if this tax collector was a Jew, they would be hated for all these things. And we know this tax collector is a Jew because what is he doing in the parable? He's at the temple praying, right? So we have two Jews, one a Pharisee, one a tax collector who would be pretty much hated for his job, okay? But what happens here? The big contrast is the pride of the Pharisee versus the humility of the tax collector. And I want to take you through a history of Paul's writing to illustrate a point. I'm going to read you four verses. You don't need to turn there because we'll go through these quickly. And I'm going to read you in order how Paul talks about himself in his books. Not all the books, okay? So we'll start in Galatians, which is one of the first one he writes. We'll then go to 1 Corinthians, which is kind of in the middle of his ministry. Then we'll go to Ephesians, which is later in his ministry. And then we'll go to 1 Timothy, which is like one of the last books that he writes. Okay, and I just want you to see the progression about how he views himself in the ministry, or just simply how he views himself in general. Okay, so this is Galatians 1, verse 1. Paul, an apostle, not of men, neither by man, but by Jesus Christ and God the Father. So he starts by saying, I am an apostle who has been chosen and sent by God himself. Okay. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, this is verse 9, for I am the least of the apostles. So in his first book, he sets himself up, and maybe he does this to give himself credibility in the writing or as he's working with, but we see he says, I'm an apostle of God. Then in his second, the second one we look at here, I'm an apostle, but I am the least of all the apostles. Then we go to Ephesians chapter 3, verse 8. Unto me who am less than the least of all saints. No longer says he's even an apostle. I'm a lower saint. Then in 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 15, this is a common verse. This is a faithful saying and worthy of all acceptation that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am chief. So he gets to the point later in his life where he says, I'm not even worthy to be called an apostle. I am the chief of all sinners. And when we put this in context again with the Sermon on the Mount, right, what is one of the first Beatitudes? Blessed are the poor in spirit. This idea that we are so destitute spiritually that we have nothing of value that we can give to God to save ourselves. We are completely and wholly dependent on him. And that's the attitude that Paul has exhibited as he's matured in his faith. That's the attitude that the tax collector is exhibiting in his prayer. It is the antithesis of the attitude that the Pharisee is exhibiting. And I could go to James 4, chapter 6, which we don't need to, because I'm sure as I start to say it, you'll know, you'll understand, you'll remember the verse. God resists the proud, but he gives grace to who? The humble. And so when we think about what is true religion, what is the attitude that we should say, or what is the attitude that we should have? True religion, and we talked about this in our group today, it's not comparing ourselves to others. It's not saying, oh, I am more spiritually mature than this person, or I have this knowledge that this person doesn't, or I have done this work that this person doesn't. True religion is understanding that the only comparison that actually matters is how we compare in relationship to God. And if we don't have Christ, we will never be able to come into his presence because we will always fall short. That's the attitude. And I came across this as, what the parable might look like today. Humility is the essence of greatness. A young girl was visiting Beethoven's home, and she sat down and played his piano. The tour guide then told of a master pianist who visited the week prior. Well, the girl said, he must have done the same thing as I did. He must have sat down and played this piano. But the tour guide responded, he said, the man said, I will not play this piano because I am not worthy to play Beethoven's piano, right? That's the idea here, that once we understand what we're really like, and the attitude, and just that we fall so much short, we can never be prideful, right? because we're always in comparison to God, never in comparison to others. So that's the parable, the Pharisaical prayer. Second one we're going to look at tonight is, go ahead and turn to Luke chapter 16. So just a couple pages earlier. So as I said, this is the rich man and Lazarus. As I mentioned, there is some debate, right? We talked about the debate, whether this is a parable or not. We've kind of dealt with this. Some people actually suggest, if you've read The Pilgrim's Progress, right, you know that John Bunyan picks names that represent the characters. So the primary character is who? Christian. And then you have other characters like pliable or obstinate or faithful, right, or whatever, right? And each of the names is selected to identify what that person is like. Some people have suggested that that's actually what's going on in this account, and therefore it is a true parable because the name Lazarus was just picked to represent the character of the person. I don't know if that's true or not. I find it interesting. So, for example, Lazarus, the name itself means God is my help. In contrast, you have the rich man who thinks he needs no help because he has everything that he needs. Actually, in Jewish legend, they say that the rich man's name was Dives, D-I-V-E-S. Again, I don't know where that comes from or if it's true or not, but in Jewish legend, that's the name they give to the rich man, which means, and the reason they do so is because that name means rich. Okay, so it makes sense. So we have this comparison and contrast, the rich man or Dives versus Lazarus. And what I want to do is compare them in life versus what they were like or what the outcome is in death. So we have this rich man. Let me go ahead and read the passage here. I think I failed to do that. So Luke chapter 16, let's start in verse 19. So there was a certain rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen and fared sumptuously every day. There was a certain beggar named Lazarus who was laid at his gate full of sores and desiring to be fed with the crumbs that fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, the dogs came and licked his sores. And it came to pass that the beggar died and was carried by the angels into Abraham's bosom. The rich man also died and was buried. And in hell he lift up his eyes, being in torments, and seeing Abraham afar off and Lazarus in his bosom. And he cried and said, Father Abraham, have mercy on me and send Lazarus that he may dip the tip of his finger in the water and cool my tongue, for I am tormented in this flame. But Abraham said, Son, remember that you in your lifetime received thy good things and likewise Lazarus evil things, but now he is comforted and you are tormented. And beside all this, between us and you, there is a great gulf fixed so that they which would pass from here to you cannot, neither you can pass to us that would come thence. And it goes on, but that kind of gets to the main points here. So in life, we have this comparison. So Lazarus, right, in verse 19, he was clothed in purple and fine linen. So purple was this very expensive dye. I found out it came from a sea snail. So they'd harvest sea snails and then, I don't know, squeeze them. I don't know, whatever. The dye would then come out and they'd collect it. Okay, and obviously they wouldn't get, I don't know how it works. But they would get enough where they would sell it. And essentially, it would cost 1 year's wage to buy like a standard, let's say an ounce of purple dye. So a year. So therefore, the only people wearing purple were the wealthy people, right? They also, what we see here is he was, we know the Jews took the Sabbath very strictly. We know all the laws that they had for the Sabbath. What we don't tend to focus on is the Jews, while they took the Sabbath very, very seriously and they wanted to rest on the Sabbath, they were very clear that you should work the other 6 days. And so they would be very hardworking and they would do the other 6 days. So what we see in this case, though, is this man is essentially lazy, selfish, and living riotously and is essentially not working. So even though he's, you know, at rest on the Sabbath, he is essentially breaking the law by not working the other days in Jewish context here. So that's the rich man. Then we have Lazarus. We see in verse 20. Lazarus, who was laid at his gate, and I'll be honest, I'll be 52 this week. I'm old. So anyways, sorry. We have, for the last 52 years of my life, every time I've read this parable, I think, oh, Lazarus is just kind of laying around, right? He's laying there waiting for someone to come help him. If you look at the wording behind this, though, it's more the idea that the word that's interpreted laid here is this context that someone simply threw him down in this spot out of impatience, or just so it's kind of like his friends were just grudgingly helping him and just threw him there and wanted someone else to take care of him. So years ago, when we before you at our old house we lived at, it was a little bit out, not in the country necessarily, but we had some property. And one night we're actually laying in bed and we see police lights show up in our little driveway there. And I like, what's going on? So I go out, and the cop starts asking me questions, which is not a good sign. But he starts, you know, hey, do you have anybody staying with you? No, I don't think so. Any friends? No. Well, what had happened was they found a man in the back part of our property where someone had just thrown him under a tree and just left him. That's kind of the context here, that they had just dropped him. We're going to deal with him. Someone else's problem, okay? So he's staying there, and he says he's waiting for the crumbs. I've learned also, history is, I'm not like a big history person, but it helps you understand this stuff. Many rich Jewish people during this time would not use napkins. But what they would do is they would have their servants bake extra bread, and they would actually take the bread and use it to wipe their hands off instead of using a napkin. And think about what would happen if you took a loaf of bread and you wiped it on yourself. What would happen? The crumbs would fall. That's what he's waiting for, okay? So that's in life, that's the contrast. In death, then what we see is, obviously, the rich man goes and he's in Hades or hell, the afterlife here, waiting. Again, I've done a series on heaven and what happens in the, you know, what we have to look forward to. So this would be what we would call the temporary heaven or temporary hell. And then it says that Lazarus is carried into Abraham's bosom. Well, this is, remember Jesus on the cross. What does he say to the thief on the cross? Today you will be with me where? In paradise. Well, Abraham's bosom was considered like the highest aspect of paradise, okay? So that's kind of what we see here. And again, I don't want to get into the actual doctrine behind this, and I don't think we can necessarily build a doctrine on what heaven and hell will look like from this one parable. But we do see that we remember things, identity remains. And so, you know, in hell, I think probably our memories will remain, and people in hell it will be a continual memory of repentance and a continual memory of regret. I mean, think about those times in your life where you have regretted a decision and having to live with that for eternity. That's part of the suffering. So we see that. Now, we then get, okay, so what principles can we draw from this? And I got to think, the rich man, he was living sumptuously, right? And he wasn't working, so by Jewish law, maybe there's some things he could be criticized for. But he didn't hurt Lazarus. He allowed him to be there. He allowed him to have the crumbs from his table. So what's, you know, in life, right, what's the problem here? And what we see is, you know, he just seemed to accept Lazarus as if he was just part of the landscape. Like, this is normal. He accepted his suffering and didn't take any responsibility for it. And let me read you. These are the lyrics from a song, from the chorus of a song. It says, it's talking to Jesus, give me your eyes for just one second so that I can see everything that I keep missing. Give me your love for humanity. Give me your arms for the brokenhearted, the ones that are far beyond my reach. Give me your heart for the ones forgotten. Give me your eyes so I can see. That's why the rich man was having problems. Or that's why the rich man is in the state that he's in, because he only focused on himself and never focused on, as we saw in the earlier parable, his relationship with Christ, and never went to the relationship. And so we see this, that some principles we can take is we need to count the cost, right? So what we do in the kingdom today has eternal consequences tomorrow. And I just kind of, as I was thinking through this, one thing that really hit me is we make this statement a lot, ignorance is not bliss. Or ignorant, we make the statement, ignorance is bliss, right? Sometimes it's just easier not to know, because as soon as we know something, we become responsible. And as this man, this rich man, just was ignorant of the circumstances around him and was so focused on his own happiness and his own wealth that he failed to recognize everything that was going on around him. Okay, the third and last parable we'll look at today is the parable of the two sons. So you can go and turn to Matthew chapter 21. Let me go ahead and read this. We'll look at start at verse 28. So Matthew 21, verse 28. But what do you think? A certain man had two sons. And again, there's debate about this one, whether it's talking about real people because it uses that word certain. Doesn't really matter here. Again, we have this comparison contrast. A certain man had two sons, and he came to the first and said, "Son, go work today in my vineyard." He answered and said, "I will not." But afterward he repented and went. He came to the second son and said likewise, and he answered and said, "I will go, sir." But he did not go. Which of them did the will of his father? They, the people in the crowd here, saying to him, the first. Jesus said unto him, "Verily I say unto you that the publicans and the harlots go into the kingdom of God before you. For John came unto you in the way of righteousness, and you believed him not. But the publicans and the harlots believed him, and you, when you had seen it, repented not afterwards that you might believe him." So we have this contrast, right? So we have the first son. So he refuses to work, but he has this change of heart and realizes I did not do the right thing. He repents and he goes and does the work. So this is representative of the sinners and the tax collectors, right? So we see in a couple of the parables today, the publicans, the tax collectors, this would be harlots as well as are referenced here. And so it's talking about these people who recognize their sin, come to a relationship in Christ, and end up in the kingdom. Then you have the second son, who promised to work but did not. So this is the Pharisees and the religious leaders. They pledged allegiance. And think back to a few weeks ago when we talked about the parable of the talents. And what did, so the talents were given, and who got criticized? In both instances, the people who got one talent, and they went and did what? They hid it in a field and did nothing with it. That's the same context here, that the Pharisees were called, they were given all these potential benefits, the Jews as a people, yet the Pharisees in particular did nothing of value for God. They simply put a wall around the law and kept it for themselves. They did nothing else with it. And so this parable is really one, here's the thing. If I had to pick one theme that really is the underlying current throughout all the parables, throughout all the kingdom, it is the difference between coming inwardly versus outwardly to Christ. And it, as to put it in the words that Pastor would have used, it's all about the heart. What we believe, and do we live it out? It's not simply about all the actions on the outside. It's what is in the heart that really matters. And so that's what it's words can never place to the heart. That's the broader context. And, you know, in earlier days, Christianity was called the way. So it was like, okay, are you part of the way? And it represented a life of belief that was lived out in practice. And I thought a lot about this week about this question. If you told somebody that you were a Christian, would they be surprised or would that be expected? And that really is, for me, that's what I really took away from this parable, is that I want people to know that I am a Christian. Not just that I say I'm one, but that it gets lived out in practice. And it's interesting that Some Jews thought that the first son actually did right, because it was more of a sin to tell your father no than it was to actually disobey them. I've been in some cultures where I've talked to some missionaries where they have experienced that, where the people in country, I'm sure you did as well, they will simply, oh yes, pastor, I will do that, or I will be there. No intention to do so, but it would be more of a sin in their eyes to disrespect the person than it would be to actually tell them the truth. That's what we see in practice here. And so I've talked, for those of you who've heard me teach at all, that you probably remember this, is that I view faith, and I mentioned this a week or two ago, that faith has three elements. There is, again, you look in Hebrews, faith is the substance, right? So there's this evidence for it, of things hoped for. So there's a heart aspect. And then we see in James that faith is how we know your faith, we know it by your works. And so there's a heart element, which we tend to focus on a lot. So here, in our circles today, we tend to focus on Christianity as simply saying, I believe. And we disconnect that from our actions. The Pharisees did the exact opposite. They focused on all the actions without any of the belief or true relationship that went along with it. But true faith, or what the Bible says is unfeigned faith, is all of these elements. That we have to believe, we have to accept, and we have to do the faith. We have to do the will of the Father. And so that's so in this context, right, you know, I would say, which of these two did right? In the end, I mean, Christ says that, you know, the second one did right. But the ideal scenario is that when Christ calls us, that we say yes and we do it, right? That's what he wants from us. So how do we take all this and draw some applications from it? So the kingdom applications for today is kingdom living requires humility. It's never about us. It's always about God. We cannot live in pride, and we've talked about this in my former growth group. We did a book on humility. And so pretty much every week, whatever the question was, you could just answer humility, and you were right, okay? Because that was pretty much it. Chase, if you were in the group, I see Chase there, right? So it got a little repetitive, but you know, sometimes you need to be hitting on the head a number of times, right? So humility, pedigree has no impact on kingdom identity. Here's the thing. Just because you're a Baptist doesn't mean you're any better than anyone else. Just because you were born into a Christian home doesn't mean you're any more mature than someone who wasn't. Right? What's the common phrase? There's no grandchildren in the kingdom. Everybody has to be the own true child of God. Everybody has to make that decision for themselves. True wealth is measured not on the scale that we think of today. Those who live in the kingdom find contentment with God has graciously provided. And for some, God may give them more. For others, it may be less. But God's going to give us what we need at the time we need it. And true faith requires both mind and will. And be careful in what you trust, as we saw with the rich man. So again, in terms of this context between religion and relationship, I really want to focus on our relationship with Christ should result or exhibit particular types of attitudes: humility, respect, doing the will of the Father. And that's how people know. And again, I leave you with this question. If you told your neighbor you were a Christian, would they be surprised? If you told your coworker you were a Christian, would they be surprised? And if the answer is yes, then the question becomes, are we really living out our faith as we should? So I have one more night, which will be next Sunday. So we'll finish this up. We'll look at a few more parables in the same type of category. So we have a few minutes extra tonight. So I'll turn it over to Blair for a song, and then we'll go from there.